So part one then of the book. The book is divided into the two parts, insight as activity. What am I doing when I know what's going on? And then insight as knowledge. Why is doing that knowing? And what do I know when I do it? So the first part then, insight as activity. And the first task is to attain familiarity with the act of insight. And this can be done through very simple examples. We were invited to supply our own, whether they're scientific or philosophical, or whether they're in the more ordinary, common, everyday domain of problems, human relationships, and so on. Insight functions, as we'll see in detail in chapters 6 and 7, in everyday living, just as it does in science and mathematics, and so on. So it begins with the insight of Archimedes. He was faced with the problem of determining whether this crown was made of gold or not. And the insight basically has to do with the ratio of the weight of a given volume of one substance to that of an equal volume of another substance. That was the insight. Weigh it in water and see about the ratio of the weight to the equal volume of water, the displacement, and so on. And that insight, and the thing is to focus on the insight and not on the insight as an act, reveals at least five characteristics of insight. So what he's doing here is beginning with the description of the experience of insight, the experience of the release to the tension of inquiry, and that's the first point, that insight comes as a release to the tension of inquiry. It satisfies an antecedent desire. It's the fruit of an antecedent effort. This first description then of the desire to know within us, deep within us all, emergent when the noise of other appetites is still, there is a drive to know, to understand, to see why. To see why, to discover the reason, to find the cause, to explain. The fact of inquiry, beyond all doubt, it can absorb one and can keep one for hours, day after day, year after year, in the narrow prison of one's study or one's laboratory. It can send one on dangerous voyages of exploration, withdraw one from other interests, other pursuits, other pleasures, other achievements. It can fill one's waking thoughts, hide from one the world of ordinary affairs, and invade the very fabric of one's dreams. And endless sacrifices that are made without regret, though there is under the hope and under a certain promise of success. There is the story, you know, that Larry tells frequently about Sir Isaac Newton, when he was working out the laws of motion and just withdrawn from other interests, other pursuits, locked up in his room for weeks working this thing out. His food would come and he'd eat it, and that would be it. Filled with this drive to get it figured out, get it right, understand. Invading the very fabric of one's dreams in terms of science, Kekulé, the chemist who discovered the structure of the benzene ring, it was basically an image that came in a dream. And it was the dream, of course, of one who was trying to answer a question. But there was an image that came in a dream that gave him the insight into what he was looking for. So, secondly, insight comes suddenly and unexpectedly, in a flash, on a trivial occasion, in a moment of relaxation, just as with Archimedes taking a bath, and all of a sudden it was the water, of course, that did it, that brought the sun. It's reached in the last analysis not by learning rules, not by following precepts, not by studying any methodology. Discovery is a new beginning, the origin of new rules that supplement or even supplant the old. Genius is creative. It is genius precisely because it disregards established routines, because it originates the novelties that will be the routines of the future. There are no rules for discovery, no precepts for genius except the transcendental precept, be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsible. And so too a teacher cannot make a pupil understand, but can only present sensible elements in an issue in a suggested order and with a proper distribution. So those are the first two of the descriptive characteristics, the release to the tension of inquiry, generally comes suddenly, unexpectedly, all of a sudden, that something has fallen into place. Thirdly, insight is a function not of outer circumstances, but of inner conditions. And this marks what he calls the strange difference between insight and sensation. Unless one is deaf, one cannot avoid hearing. Unless one is blind, one has only to open one's eyes to see. The occurrence and the content of insight of sensation stand in some immediate correlation with outer circumstance. But with insight, it is internal conditions that are paramount. Insight depends upon native endowment. It depends upon a habitual orientation, upon a perpetual alertness, ever asking the little question why, persistence. Finally, it depends on the accurate presentation of definite problems. That last condition is related to the correct constellation of images, which we'll see is extremely important. Okay, I think these points, these descriptive points, are fairly easy to grasp. But the fourth one as well, but we're getting a little bit more technical with this fourth one. Insight pivots between the concrete and the abstract, or at least in common sense, the general. We will generalize from insight. So I think that's one of the things that's really difficult in terms of human relationships, when you get into a terrific amount of trouble by generalizing insight, because common sense insight is into a concrete situation and it's not easily generalizable. But in science, insight pivots between the concrete and the abstract. In science, the problem is concrete, and so is the solution. But the point of the intervening procedure involves abstract correlations and laws. The problem is this made of gold? And the answer is either yes or no. But in between, there are the laws of specific gravity and displacement that are arrived at through the experimentation that he hit upon with this insight, measuring these respective ratios. So if insights arise from concrete problems, if they reveal their value in concrete applications, nonetheless they possess a significance greater than their origins and a relevance wider than their original applications. So his insight, for instance, wasn't only valid for that situation. It obtained for all similar situations. Because insights arise with reference to the concrete, geometers will use diagrams, mathematicians need pen and paper, teachers need blackboards, pupils have to perform experiments, doctors have to see their patients, troubleshooters have to travel to the spot, people with a mechanical bent take things apart to see how they work. But because the significance and relevance of insight goes beyond any concrete problem or application, people formulate abstract sciences with their numbers and symbols, their technical terms and formulae, the definitions, postulates, and deductions. Thus, by its very nature, insight is the mediator, the hinge, the pivot. It is insight into the concrete world of sense and imagination. And yet, what is known by insight, what it adds to sensible and imagined presentations, finds its adequate expression only in the abstract and recondite formulations of the sciences. Now, we'll see a little bit more towards the end of the chapter precisely what he means by abstraction, but in this case, at this point, all he's meaning by it is that it holds for more than this concrete instance. It's not just an insight into this concrete instance. But what you arrive at, and if you verify it, well, then it's valid for all similar circumstances. And finally, then we'll pause here after this one and see if we've got any questions up to that point. Insight passes into the habitual texture of one's mind. Once you have understood anything, you've crossed a divide. Now, this is with a certain amount of give and take on this, because we can reach a certain understanding and then we get wrapped up in other things, and years later we might have to go back and review it again. But what a moment ago was an insoluble problem now becomes incredibly simple and obvious. And you find this like with reading a book. When reading a book like Insight, as you go along, believe me, it will become more. Once you get into the way he writes, what he's onto, and so on, you'll almost, by the end of the course, you'll be anticipating what he's going to say. But, however laborious the first occurrence of an insight may be, subsequent repetitions occur almost at will. This constitutes the possibility of learning. And we can learn in as much as we can add insight to insight, inasmuch as the new does not extrude the old, but complements and combines it. Conversely, inasmuch as the subject to be learnt involves the acquisition of a whole series of insights, the process of learning is marked by an initial period of darkness in which one gropes about insecurely, in which one cannot see where one is going, in which one cannot grasp what all the fuss is about. Only gradually, as one begins to catch on, does the initial darkness yield to a subsequent period of increasing light, confidence, interest, and absorption. I find this with any book, you know, any book in philosophy and theology, when you pick it up for the first time, you really have to struggle with it. You know? But you read it and then you pick it up a couple of years later and you say, oh, okay, you have a greater sense of what it's all about. This person is on to what he or she is talking about. And I just make one observation there, that I think it's less true of insights in the common sense realm, and especially with regard to human relationships, that they necessarily pass into the habitual textual one's mind. We keep making the same mistakes. And it's something, wisdom, the acquisition of wisdom is partly concerned with learning from your mistakes and not repeating them over and over again. But we can get into these patterns, and particularly if we're taped, you know, to get into these patterns, wired to get into them, it can be very difficult to break it. And Lonergan will present a reason for that in chapter 6, that the insights in the common sense realm have to take place in the dramatic pattern of experience, not the intellectual pattern of experience. You can have all kinds of insights in the intellectual pattern of experience into your behavior, but you don't do anything at all. But if they are occurring in the dramatic pattern in which you're living, that is different, and then they're liable to have more effect. We'll see more of that. So I'd like to pause for a moment, see if we're okay just on these descriptive points that we made. That's the experience of insight. Yes, Sean.
I never understood fully the second point. Why insights come at this moment of breath? Why can't they come when you're actively trying to figure something out? And the second half of that paragraph, 129, sometimes for me doesn't just jive with the first part. I mean, he starts with the story of Archimedes, and Archimedes at rest, but then he gives the example of the students in the classroom, and some of them get it while they're actively trying to get it.
I think it's more the unpredictability of it that he's trying to get at. That it can't be programmed, and it's not a result of any kind of deductive process or something. It's not like I can set up a computer to do things just the way I want. I mean, I can't, but some people can. Set up a computer to do things just as they want them to do them, and it's all programmed. And there's no kind of, there's no program like that for this. And so the arising, like when I've taught this course, for instance, in the past, I find that a lot of people really get it in chapter 12. But not everybody gets it there, but it can happen elsewhere, you know? And so I think that's the main thing. It's the suddenness and the unexpectedness and the lack of programming. You can set the conditions in yourself by wanting to, by surrounding yourself with the things that will help, and by having a good teacher who is able to lay the materials out in a certain way. So I think that's more. But it also is true that there are times when you go to bed at night with a problem and you wake up with the answer.
Yeah, I don't disagree with the experience. I mean, I understand exactly what he's talking about, but...
But I don't think he means to say that it's always in a period of relaxation, because it is true that in the classroom in particular, if people are relaxing too much, they're not going to get anything. But there's a kind of a... There's something that is universal about that relaxation thing is that you have to move beyond a mindset of instrumentalization utilitarian into a mode of letting be, and allowing the form of intelligibility to emerge. And that will emerge if we're in the mindset of the same kind of mindset that we're in, for instance, when we have to drive a car in heavy traffic. Well, you've got to be attentive. You can't be concerned with whatever. You don't cross a busy street in the intellectual pattern of experience. You don't get to the other side. You've got to watch out for other things.
Yes. So I guess it's a related question to Sean's. Maybe I was just looking at it in a different way. But it seems to me like there's arriving at an insight while you're solving a problem, and then there's having an insight communicated to you which you pick up. It seems like they're very different. They're very different processes. No?
Can you say a little bit more about that? I think I understand what you're saying.
Well, for instance, I've read this thing. I read the chapter, and in the chapter he invites you to do your own experiments with insight. So the next thing I did was I picked up another book. I read something in the book. I never thought about that before. I thought, wow, that's an insight. But I'm not struggling to solve a problem, and it's not, it just seems that the communication of that insight, I didn't create an image, I didn't go through the steps or the way he describes it. It just seems like there's a very different process. Once somebody has gone through all the trouble and difficulty of arriving at an insight, which usually is a very creative process, they communicate the insight, and there's not nearly as much creativity involved on the part of the recipient of that information as there was from the person who generated that original insight.
And I think those are two distinct moments. And I think that the second one has to do more with the receptivity of understanding, and understanding as receiving. At the same time, if it was like a wow, that's really good sort of thing, then there has to be something going on there. You wanted to know what this person had to communicate to you, so that the desire is on to there. And there must have been some kind of imaginative framework that was, even if it's the words in concatenation with each other. Images do not have to be visual. They can be auditory, they can be kinetic, they can be they can be in language. Language can provide. And as you know, with mathematics, the images can be mathematical formulae that for you will contain a pattern that will enable you to understand. And for other people, it would be like a completely foreign language. It doesn't make any sense at all. But for you, it's the correct concatenation. There are images in those formulas. But it is a different experience. It's not your problem.
Right.
It's not your question. It's rather someone else communicating to you what he or she has arrived at through this fact of original insight. And then you have to, of course, you have to make that your own, and you've got to test it, and so on and so forth. But it is a different moment of coming to understand. There is a difference. That's true.
If images do not have to be visual, can you say those other realms that would constitute image? You said auditory. Did I hear you say
that? Yeah, auditory, kinetic, tactile. Helen Keller as an instance.
Yes.
Helen Keller was probably incapable of having visual images. Probably incapable. Because she was blind from birth. And she was a person who had an enormous amount of insight in her life, and she wrote all kinds of books about how exciting it is to learn. Mm-hmm. But the original breakthrough for her was a tactile image of the nurse with the signs for water on her hand, and at the same time pouring water over her hand. And she got it, that these signs meant that this mediated that. Meaning. this image, but it's not, it was not a visual image, it's a tactile image. Tactile a concatenation of sensations organized for the sake of insight. She had an insight into that image, but it was not a visual image.
So if a symbol is an image of a real or an imaginary
object,
the sight, the sound, the taste, the feel, the color of the object.
And with a, when the mathematician is in into pure mathematics, for instance, which is an experience that I'm not talking about from a great deal of experience, but the images are provided by the ongoing sequence of these formulae that, okay, they are visual, he or she can see them or imagine them, the letters and numbers and so on and so forth. But it's not what we normally conceive of as a visual image, which is usually some kind of picture. But I think the Helen Keller thing is a very clear example of how an image does not have to be visual, and yet it's her insight is into the image. The image is a concatenation of sensations containing intelligent data. Concatenation need not be made.
What is concatenation?
Grouping together.
C-A-N?
Concatenation.
Thank you.
Anything more?
Just that I noticed that he, this, to respond to a couple of things, the first section he titles a dramatic instance. So I think he's deliberately using a dramatic instance of insight to get at a more generalized emotion.
I think that's true. And not everybody is as excited by their images as Archimedes was. And part of the reason for his excitement might not be that he found the answer, but that he might have saved his life. But it also is extremely exciting if you've been wrestling with something for a long time and then all of a sudden a lot of stuff tumbles into place. That is very exciting. Just the whole intellect, it's a wonderful intellectual experience. The unification of that field of knowing, you know, even if it's a small little thing, all of a sudden, God. Okay. All right, let's move then to the next part, the second example, which has to do with the definition, arriving at a definition. It might be good here if you've ever arrived at a definition of something, whether it's your own, it might be a good thing. Otherwise, we can take the one that he gives and that's what we do. A second example of insight is arriving at a definition of something or at the understanding of a definition. And even this, you know, this is not by any means as dramatic as the first instance. I mean, to be able to define a circle as a locus of coplanar points equidistant in the center is not, I mean, it should make sense, but it's not particularly exciting. So there's the dramatic tone has moderated. He uses the circle as an example, but as I said a minute ago, if you've ever arrived at a definition, use that as your example. Psychic conversion is the transformation of the sensor from a repressive to a constructive functioning in one's development. That's a definition that I offer to something, and I think it's accurate. Anyway, that's just an example. In the definition of the circle, you want the imminent reason for ground, for the roundness of a wheel. And so you don't introduce other data, carts and carting and transportation and wheelwrights and tools. Right? There you're dealing with efficient causality, final causality, to use the scholastic categories, but that's not. You simply consider the wheel Why is it round? What makes it round? You try a suggestion. Now, this is the imagination going to work here. The wheel is round because its spokes are equal. Well, the spokes could be equal, but they could be unevenly placed into one end or the other. So that's not quite enough, but it's giving you a clue. And the point is to push the clue for all it's worth. Once you're onto it, and that's the beginning of insight. The clue is the beginning of the insight. You're thinking. This is a case now of thinking for the sake of understanding, for the sake of insight. And it's less sudden than the instance of activities. And it's less, certainly it's less dramatic, and it's more an insight that's arrived at by some kind of plotting intellectual activity, thinking for insight. So let the hub decrease to a point and the rim and the spokes thin out into lines. And then you see that the wheel is round inasmuch as the distance from the center of the hub to the outside of the rim is always the same. And that's what enables you to give the definition of a locus of coplanar points equidistant from the center. And in this case, now we'll see in the next chapter in particular that this is not the case in science, but in this case you're grasping necessity and impossibility, that it must be. It's a must here, if, in fact, the distance from the center of the hub to the outside of the rim is always the same. It must be. You're grasping necessity, and you're grasping impossibility. It's impossible for it not to be round, if that is. Okay. Now, what's happened in this example? First of all, you have transcended imagination. Points and lines cannot be imagined. They're concepts. Okay. So he's not talking here about dots and threads. Okay. He's talking about transcending all of that, because a dot has a certain magnitude, and so does the thread has a certain width to it. He's talking about something that has no magnitude. All breadth and depth have disappeared. And you're into the conceptual realm. They've been arrived at by thinking, by supposing. So thinking for the sake of insight. You begin with the clue, the equality of the spokes, and you push it until you've transcended imagination and moved into conception. Concepts then are constituted by the mere activity of supposing, thinking, considering, formulating, defining. Let us suppose that this is the case. And they don't occur at random, but in conjunction with an act of insight. Note that this relation, what we talked about this last week, this relation between understanding and conceptualization is a major issue for Lyman. Insight into images is the ground of conceptualization. If you want to study this in detail and how he arrived at this, you can see it in Barrett in chapter 1, his study of Thomas in chapter 1 in particular. Still, there's a two-way process. Knowing is discursive. We think in order to understand, and we cannot think without concepts. And when we understand, our thinking is clarified. And I want to just indicate here, the issue is much more complex than this, but for now, I think we're doing well to grasp that there's a two-way process here. And the process that he's particularly interested in is how insight gives rise to conceptualization. We use concepts in order to arrive at insights, and insight gives rise to new concepts. Lauderdale's point is that new conceptualizations emerge from insights. Is that clear? There is a two-way street, but the point that he's really trying to make is that any new conceptualization will arise from your original insight. Yes, ma'am.
So where does meaning come
from? Meaning?
Meaning. How do we understand? Do we understand it? Do we derive meaning or knowledge?
The insight is the well, okay. The full thing on that, an approximation to the full theory of meaning is that the acts of meaning are multiple. Potential acts of meaning, formal acts of meaning, and full acts of meaning are the ones that he will talk about in insight. The method in theology will go on to talk about constitutive acts of meaning. effective. These are spoken of in insight, but not named as such as constitutive and effective acts of meaning. Potential acts of meaning are sense, image, question, and even insight itself. Because in insight itself, the knower and the known are still identical. The formal act of meaning is in the conceptualization, where there arises a distinction of meaning from meant. I mean something, and that the something is what is expressed in the conceptualization. The full act of meaning is the judgment, where you with confidence say yes or no. In that sense, there's a fullness to it. And you're able to assent or you withhold assent and know why you're assenting and why you withhold it. And constitutive meaning is the meaning that we, community, for instance, is constituted by meaning. Any human community is a matter of common meaning. It's constituted by the meanings and values that are shared in common in the community. Family is constituted by meaning. The state is constituted by meaning. If you change the meaning of the state, you change the reality of the political confederation at the same time. The state is constituted by meaning. As he put it, I've got it in the quote on the front page of our bulletin, which came out yesterday. It's a quote that I used. But if you change the constitution, you are changing the political reality of the country. If you parliamentary democracy and democracy in the United States are both democracy, but there's also a difference. And if you lived in both countries, you have, after a while, you get a sense of the difference, even if you can't say precisely what it is, but they look a little bit different, and yet they're both democratic societies. So, and it's the Constitution, but if you change that, I mean, if Canada were to become a republic and not a constitutional monarchy, which is what it is now, we would be changing something of the political reality, but we're changing the meaning first. Well, that's what constitutive meaning is all about. The change in the meaning is a change in the political reality. A change in the meaning of the religious community is a change in the reality or anything. But anyway, these are the, so meaning is present here all the way through, but in different ways. The formal meaning, the difference between potential meaning and formal meaning is that in acts of potential meaning, the meaning and the meant are identical. The sense in act is the sense of what in act. In a situation where there are no auditory powers at all, there are only sound waves. There's no actual sound. Because you've got to have an ear to have actual sound. There's the potential for sound. The sound occurs only if there are animals or human beings and ears to hear. Actual sound. So meaning and meant are identical. In conceptualization, they begin to become distinct. As we work out what it is that we've understood, well, then we objectify. Once we objectify, then we're making a distinction between the subject and the object. And then in judgment, we are pronouncing upon the validity of what we have come to understand. So that's probably a fuller answer to this one.
So the insight itself is still only potential meaning.
That's right, the way he puts it in Method and Theology.
But it's only the inner word that begins to move into form.
It was an interesting thing, and at first I found it strange that he would say that, but the method where he lines it up this way in Method and Theology, the potential is defined by the identity of knower and known, and in insight they're still identical, and then they begin to become distinct as you conceptualize and objectify and talk about it and put it into words and so distinction that happens in that way. That, of course, is the difference between Platonic and Aristotelian knowing, is that for Aristotle, there is the identity first, begin with an identity knower, move to distinction and conceptualization, whereas with Plato and all most spontaneous cognitional theories, there's confrontation from the beginning. The object is out there, the subject is here, I'll take a look at it, there's a distinction. Yes.
It seems to be, like from my own experience in the scientific area, when one comes to an insight, things come together, it connects, there's a connection, etc.
That's right.
But the next question is, not only what does it mean, what are the implications, all of the other questions then all of a sudden come out of there.
I mean, every insight gives rise to further questions.
But there's a whole that you have come to, and then there's a lot more, and it goes beyond that.
Okay. Thirdly, then, the image was necessary for the insight. You've arrived at an insight that grasps, in this case, necessity and impossibility. These cannot be imagined, but the necessity and impossibility are not in the abstract, but a necessity and an impossibility resulting from these equal and unequal radii. If you eliminate the image of the center, the radii, and the curve, you lose the grasp of the necessary or the impossible roundness, and that grasp is what constitutes the insight. Pardon me, I had the impossibility wrong before. If they're not equal, it's impossible to get that big grip. That's why you don't have the grasp of impossibility. So you have grasped necessity and impossibility in the concrete image, and that grasp constitutes your insight. Insight, then, as he says on 33, is the act of catching on to a connection between imagined equal radii and, on the other hand, a curve that is bound to the radii. Okay. Right. Fourthly, then, there is the question, the why, the psychological tension that has its release in the joy of discovery, the drive, the desire to understand, the primordial why, alertness of mind, intellectual curiosity, the spirit of inquiry, active intelligence, what the scholastics call agent intellect. The desire to know, rather than desire to know, is Aristotle's and Thomas's agent intellect. He makes that point any number of times. Agent intellect is a metaphysical term for the same thing. But psychologically, it's described as the desire to know. The pure question that human consciousness and its authenticity is prior to any insights, any concepts, any words. The insights, concepts, words have to do with answers. And before we look for answers, we want them. And such wanting is the pure question. And as we'll see in chapters 6 and 7, there is also a not wanting to understand, the flight from understanding. And though the pure question is prior to insights, concepts, and words, in its every manifestation it presupposes experiences and images, data. We always wonder about something. Notice what's happening here is that he's moving more from description to explanation. He's relating things to one another. Concepts, images, questions, insights are now getting related to one another. And that becomes clear in this next point, the moments in the genesis of the definition. First, the emergence of the desire to understand. Question, why is it gone? Second, the hint, the suggestion, the clue, the beginning of insight. Third, the cooperation of imagination with intellectual effort, running parallel to intelligent suppositions, letting your imagination go to work, helping you along. Restraining your suppositions within some limits of approximation to imaginable data. Fourth, the achievement of a pattern set of concepts. By their cooperation, by successive adjustments, question and insight, image and concept present a solid front. The answer is a pattern set of concepts. The image strains to approximate to the concepts. The concepts, by added conceptual determinations, can express their differences from the merely approximate image. The pivot between image and concept is the insight. And setting the standard that insight, images, concepts must meet is the question. And this is something that is at the heart of what he's calling self-appropriation. To acknowledge that we do have within ourselves a criteria for meaning and for truth. Setting the standard. Right? There is something about the very constitution of the human spirit that sets the standard that must be met. Setting the standard that insight, image, and concept must meet is the question, the desire to know. And if that is not satisfied, then the question continues. Because it can keep the process in motion by further queries, further questions, and its requirements not satisfied. And when we get to the chapters of judgment and reflective understanding, we'll see that basically the only criterion that we have for the yes and no, the judgment. This is an imminently generated knowledge. Now, this is not the case with faith, the ascent of faith. But an imminently generated knowledge, the only criteria that we have is, are there, on this particular issue, any further relevant questions? If the answer is yes, then I can't yet pronounce in judgment. The answer is no, the evidence is yes. I don't have any other criteria. That can be frightening, but also be exhilarating. Because it, and from a theological standpoint, our intelligence and rationality are creative participations in the life of God. Because they are there. They are equipped with the standard. Or they're equipped to set the standard that the process itself has to meet before it is satisfied. The next thing, well, let's do 13 and 14. This next is it gets a little bit tricky with the different kinds of definitions. Well, the nominal and explanatory are easy. It's the implicit definition that's a good thing. Nominal definitions merely tell us the correct usage of names. This definition of a circle is more than nominal. It tells us why it's round. It doesn't just say how you can correctly use the word circle. An example of a nominal definition is, a circle is a perfectly round plane curve. That's a nominal definition. It's true. But all it really tells you is that this is the correct use of the word circle. Explanatory definitions tell you why. They suppose a further insight into the imminent intelligibility of the object. A circle is a locus of coplanar points equidistant from the center. That not only tells you that it's a perfectly round plane curve, but it tells you why it's perfect. Now, implicit definitions are more difficult. I mean, in mathematics, they would occur with a statement like two and only two points determine a straight line. That statement fixes the meaning of both point and line. It's fixed in that statement. But it doesn't restrict point to position without magnitude or line to length without breadth or depth, but rather it gives rise to the possibility of creating an equation and defining points and lines in terms of equations. One is not restricted to the object about which one is first thinking, but can concentrate exclusively on the set of relationships in which the whole scientific significance consists. Now, this business of implicit definitions will become clearer later when Lonergan talks about terms and relations implicitly defining one another. We'll see that more and more as we go along. And even in this chapter, we'll see the example. Let numbers be defined implicitly by operations. So a number is whatever is generated by these particular operations. That operations be implicitly defined by rules and so on. Okay, and then finally, the seventh point, the last point in this particular section. Whence are the primitive terms of the definition derived? Okay, you've got the problem here, the main point of that seventh section is that you've got to distinguish insight from logic. Right? This is a logical question about primitive terms. A logician would come along and say every definition presupposes other terms, If these can be defined, their definitions will presuppose other terms. Are you to regress to infinity, or are you to arrive at some point of primitive terms? And how do you know when you've got your primitive terms? You can't regress to infinity, so are we basically being arbitrary? Are we basing our definitions on undefined terms? Are we defining terms in a circle? These are the kinds of questions that logicians can ask. Okay. Lonergan's answer to that is every definition involves several terms. No insight can be expressed by a single term, and it is not true that every insight presupposes previous insights. There are original insights, and it's those insights that give rise to the basic terms in any instance. The point is insight, not concept, and this is the difference between method and logic. Logic has a place in the whole procedure of knowing, from experience to understanding to judgment. There's a place in there for logical operations. But many of the operations that are involved in this process are non-logical operations. One place where logic becomes important is the movement from hypothesis judgment. I gave you an instance of that last week. The hypothesis is A. Well, if A, then B. That B, therefore, possibly A. That's a logical procedure. It's followed by every scientist in scientific experimentation and the verification of the hypothesis. But insight is not a logical operation. It's not irrational, it's not illogical, it's just not a logical operation. It's an intelligent operation, it's not a logical operation. And Lonergan had some very biting things to say in some of his later work about the focus on logic to such an extent that one overlooks understanding. A logician is like a mortician. He achieves a steady state only temporarily. One of his statements about logicians. A logician, like the mortician, achieves a steady state only temporarily. Anything that the logician does, it clarifies, but it's going to fall apart under the force of later questions. And Fred Crowe came down to my room just yesterday and said, I found another quotation. Logic is a matter of marking time. In other words, it doesn't move on. So it moves on in non-logical operations, asking further questions. So I think that's probably enough there. I don't think I need to, I'll read the quotation, but the big thing is don't confuse insight and logic. So for every basic insight, there's a circle of terms and relations such that the terms fix the relations fix the terms, and the insight fixes both. If you grasp the necessary and sufficient conditions for the perfect roundness of this imagined plane curve, then you grasp not only the circle, but also point, line, circumference, radii, plane, equality. All of these tumble out together because they're all needed to express adequately a single insight. They're all coherent, as coherence basically means they all hang together for the same. Pause for a moment, and then we can take a break.
The point about logic is the earlier point in Archimedes about it's not about following rules or precepts.
His Bonnigan's best treatment to show that he really was into a great deal about contemporary logic and not just Aristotle's logic, which he had a great respect for. It's the overemphasis on it for these. But the lectures on mathematical logic, the first week of the series of lectures at Boston College on mathematical logic, the second week was on existentialism. But he really was very well read in those days was contemporary mathematical logic. And the point is there that can't, well, there's a number of things, but it can't be taken as a full philosophy. It just, it's empty. It should be as a full philosophy. And you can't work that way. We don't work that way. The mind doesn't work only logically. It does work logically, but not only. And people are different in these matters. I think that people who are impatient with logic, first of all, there's a danger that you can be sloppy, because logic has the value of the entirety of any systematization.
Checking consistency of different concepts.
Yes, but at the same time, there can also be the exasperation that the heavily logical person can cause to the person who is insightful, creative, who jumps. Insight's a jump, it's a leap. And sometimes, you know, then that those people will be waiting around for the logicians to catch up. All right, let's break for 10.